of its employees using the employees' records of the Russian American company. This individual's name is Winston Sarafian, and his doctoral dissertation, I hope, will be in print soon, because he really does offer very powerful evidence that the Russian American company was not the monster that often pictured, that it did have, for its time, and certainly compared with many American institutions, a very rather progressive employee policy in terms of social welfare and caring for the health and the education of its employees. Another person who has used these files very creatively is a Russian, Svetlana Fyodorova, who has used the files to do some sociological analysis of the, well, actually it's ethnographic, but it's largely in these areas the two overlap, studies of the employee and general social implications of the Russian involvement in America. Her book has been translated into English by Richard Pierce and a group at the University of Ontario, and it is available here in Alaska now through, I no doubt, at the Downtown Library and out of the consortium too. Well, the records of the Russian American Company are of critical importance for understanding what's going on, what went on in Alaska, particularly with respect to the political, economic, and to some extent the social sphere. But one area that has been largely ignored by historians is the cultural impact of the Russians on Alaska's native peoples. Belatedly, America has begun a search for its own national heritage in terms of its native cultures. And Alaska has a unique contribution to make to this search, because for 120 or 40 or 80, wherever you want to draw the line, years, it was not Americans, but Russians who introduced the native peoples to their first taste of Western culture, to so-called civilization. And I think what we want to know is what was their special contribution, and are the native peoples in Alaska, in this portion of America, have they developed differently because of this initial contact with civilization writ large? These are important questions for all of us and for all Americans. Now, the answer to this kind of question lies in a variety of accounts. Clearly, one portion of the answer is in the Russian American Company documents. Another critical area are the files of the Russian Orthodox Church in Alaska. This area, in my opinion, has been overlooked or neglected or downgraded by almost all historians until almost the last year or two. Most historians seem to follow the opinion of Bancroft in saying that the Russian Orthodox Church was a failure in Alaska. And that is exactly, those are the words that he uses to introduce his chapter on the Russian Orthodox Church in Alaska. And he documents his assertion through quotations from individuals who were in Alaska, secular individuals. And by and large, his assessment is based on his judgment that the Orthodox Church had failed to civilize Alaska's natives, to bring them into the broad range of Western culture. Now, the question that no one has asked is that the criteria one should use to judge the success of a religious mission? It certainly is not the task which the Orthodox set for themselves. In terms of their own activity, they were interested primarily in the spiritual aspects of their work. The instructions which the great John Veniaminoff, as Bishop Innocent, gave to his missionaries emphasized respect for native customs. For a patience with customs that resisted Christianity. There is a great humane spirit in these instructions that are far too poorly known in Alaska. And I hope that they will soon become more familiar to all of you, to all of us, hopefully through some of what this archive that I will discuss in a minute will bring to light and I hope will open up many new studies. Now, the problem that I've mentioned about the access to documents has been one portion of the problem with respect to getting at the story of Russian Orthodoxy. The largest collection of Russian Orthodox documents is in the Library of Congress. It was deposited there in 1928 by the Ecclesiastical Consistory of the Russian Orthodox Church, and consisted at that time of some 700 boxes. For a period of 8 years, nothing was done with it. And then in 1936, through a grant to the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, a project was undertaken, which some of you are probably familiar with, called the Alaska History Project, Documents Relative to the History of Alaska. And one aspect of that project was to survey, literally send out a surveying party of this enormous collection to find out how valuable was the ore within. The person in charge of that was Dr. Cecil Rowe, chairman of the History Department at University of Alaska, and his expert on the scene was an Orthodox priest who was also had just received his doctorate in education, Tikhon Lavrishev. Dr. Lavrishev did a Herculean job in just 2 short years. Unfortunately, he died before the project was finished. He was a young man, his 40s. But before he could complete the task, he did die. And nonetheless, he had an extremely capable assistant who carried on and was able to put together his notes. And the result of this is 4 volumes of microfilm on the archive at the Library of Congress. Now, Dr. Lavrishev had not intended that this original survey was be an index or a calendar. It was simply to spur scholarly curiosity, to interest the scholarly community in getting into this in more detail, and to fund a full-scale index. What he did was he used apparently enormous good sense, selected really interesting pieces for complete translation, he summarized others, he did provide a complete list of all the vital statistics and all of the records that were there by year, but he didn't translate all the records. He just gave the years for which they were there. And the object then was to get money to do more. No money came in. However, 4 years later, or 2 years, in 1940, another project or another deposit was made, this time from the parish churches in Alaska. Now, the first deposit had been from the ecclesiastical files itself, the headquarters. The next deposit was from the parish churches. And a collection was made. An individual went around and gathered as many records as he could find. Many boxes, some 200 boxes, were added to that collection. No cataloging, no indexing, no description, no survey, nothing has been done with that material that was deposited in 1940. it is still, I was talking with Dick Dauenhauer last night, a linguist, who told a friend of his who had been quite aware that there was a very valuable gospel in this collection and wanted to go back and take a look at it to find out if it was indeed there. And he knew pretty much what he was looking for, and he knew where, what church it would have been from. He was willing to go through all the records of this one parish, but the Library of Congress individual simply would not. He had to sign his life away, practically, to get in and go through those things. They were still in boxes. This was just a couple of years ago. So this is obviously one of the problems of trying to find out anything about the history of Russian Orthodoxy in Alaska. There might, however, be, you might think, some clues in the press of the church. Well, there was indeed a journal called the Russian Orthodox American Messenger, which was printed for a number of years in both English and Russian, and only ceased publication, as a matter of fact, last year. It did indeed carry a great many articles on Alaska. In fact, its first years are almost entirely filled with articles on Alaska. It began publication in 1896. Well, there are individual copies of that journal in various libraries, such as Harvard, the New York Public Library, University of California. Nothing is on microfilm. And in order to get a complete picture, one has to go around all of these different libraries to use that material. By the way, almost no one has. It's just been too much work. Now we get to where we are here tonight. Last year, as Steve indicated, it goes back more than last year. A couple of years ago, Bishop Theodosius initiated a search, or discovered that this scouring of the parishes in 1940 had not really emptied them. And he brought a few documents to Sitka. Then the Bishop Gregory, who fortuitously was the archivist at Syosset, at the headquarters of the Orthodox Church in America, assigned to Alaska, we really found a person eminently well qualified to assist and to head this effort to gather more documents. Last year, an enormous cache was discovered at Russian Mission on the Yukon River. No one knows how these were missed in the first collection of parish records. They were. The archive that I, for convenience sake, have called the Alaska Archive, because it will remain in Alaska, principally, is primarily concerned with this Yukon River mission of the church. However, the church is continuing its search for amongst all of its parishes. It has turned up a number of things from the Kodiak Church. In fact, in the course of my work on this project, I have had twice already to revise my tables and list of documents because of new material that has come in. And today, after my project was finished and is going to the typist, I got a call from the bishop. I must rush down to Kodiak because they have just got another four boxes from, of all places, Russian Mission. And he said that it sounds to me from his description as if it is at least equal to everything I have worked all summer. And the project was supposed to have been finished last month. So anyway, but we will put in an appendix to the report. Now this collection of documents, you may wonder what are documents for the Russian Orthodox Church, what we mean when we're talking about documents. These are run the gamut of records and church-related things, to personal letters, to periodicals, almost anything that besides what we're talking about, are priests' journals, and the Orthodox priests were required to keep a daily journal, not only of their services, which they held, but of their travels, and of all the things that they saw and everything they heard on their travels. These were explicit instructions given by Bishop Innocent. In addition, there are metrical records, which are important vital statistics for the parish in question. Every year, I don't know how these priests had time to do anything but keep records, because not only did they keep one or even two journals and the metrical records, they also kept a church register in which they gave information about each village in the parish. The church registers are uniquely, well, each of these registers has a unique importance. The Via Domosti, or just the church register, indicates how, gives information on where villages are located, how far they are from the headquarters. And this is obviously invaluable for drawing maps of Alaska. The confessional records serve another purpose. They provide information about the village composition. How many, and these priests kept records of how many people from each tribe were in such and such a village when he visited. Now, they might not have been resident there, but they were at least there to be part of the census and take part in the communion of the time. Another important aspect of documentary evidence, of course, is correspondence. And there is a stack of correspondence about that high for this period of time. By the way, the period we're talking about is from the founding of the mission in 1845 to, the correspondence runs till 1910. The journals, the priest journals, run to about 1911, but not continuously. Now, I don't know what this new batch of stuff will, what gaps it will fill in. The bishop says that the latest that he saw was that there is one that goes all the way to 1934, and that there are Yedomosti and confessional registers and metrical records that will fill in all the gaps. So I don't know whether that is actually true, because the bishop has not seen yet my complete table, so he is not absolutely sure what they had in the original set. But I'm pretty sure that if they got four boxes, it's going to fill in a lot of holes. Now, something that is important for you to know are exactly what is the value of these documents. In our project, we had two objectives. One was to determine the bibliographic rarity of this stuff. Is it a first find? Totally unknown. Another thing we were interested in is its historiographic value. Now, the two are not necessarily related. I've already indicated just how difficult it is to use the existing materials, those at the Library of Congress. And as a matter of fact, I did discover that almost all of the material in the Alaska Archive relevant to both the Kodiak and the Kvipak or Yukon River Mission is duplicated by material in the Library of Congress. Because, of course, they all, not only do the priests keep all these records, they kept two copies of everything, one for their own files and one to send to the headquarters. So one could expect a certain amount of duplication. However, what we did find is that there is a missing portion of a very important priest journal that is not in the Library of Congress. And this is the journal of the priest Jacob Nitsvyatov, who was resident priest at the mission, founded the mission in 1845, and was there until late in the fall of 1862. We now have, thanks to this latest find, a complete run of his journals from 1845, well actually, his journals begin in 1828 when he was a priest at Atka, then he was transferred in 1845 to the Yukon River Mission because of his great abilities as a linguist, are fruitful, we may fill that gap before too many years pass. Another important item that is in this archive, it is the very first metrical record taken in the Norton Sound area up here. When they were considering what to do, when Bishop Innocent was considering where to found his new mission, or a new mission, he sent his priest, Gregory Bolivan, from Unalaska, which is on the map here, to sort of case the place and find out where the best location would be in the Yukon River area. He went first to the Russian America Company post at Mikhailovsky Redoubt and decided that was not the place for it. There wasn't enough wood, there wasn't enough game. It would not be a suitable place. But while he was there in 1843, he baptized the natives and any of those who were there and compiled the first metrical record for that entire region. And that is in this collection. And that's thrilling. That's the very first account of the peoples of that region of any sort. The decision was made after his initial visit to found the Yukon River Mission at what is at the Eskimo village called Iqaluit, because it was very near the portage to the Kuskokwim River. And there was already a Russian trading post at Kalmakoski Redoubt, and it would be very convenient to have that access. However, there was something interesting about the founding of the mission at Iqaluit. It was too far from a really well-fortified post, which was Mikhailovsky Redoubt, to have any support from the Russian America Company. They said they would support it morally and help out. They wouldn't fund it, as they had done all of the other missions. But Bishop Innocent was not one to stop at that obstacle, and he did go ahead and establish the mission, the first really independent, if you will, mission on the Yukon River. This, I hope you can see this, and it isn't as dark as I like, but this pie-shaped area is the region that was covered by the single priest and a couple of readers in that area, which is why I say I, with all of the record keeping, and it's just amazing to me that these people would do as Father Joseph Preda said, he can barely keep a record of what he's doing from day to day, and they are able to fly and have, you know, live with modern conveniences and light all the time. That he just doesn't know how they did it. Well, the correspondence is another aspect of this file, which is, as far as I can tell, unique. Now, the problem, again, is there is no index to what is in the Library of Congress, and Tikhon Labrashev did report on and translate quite a lot of correspondence, but he didn't do all of it. He just selected bits that were interesting to pique scholarly curiosity. And so I can't tell whether the correspondence is duplicated or not. I did find one item that is duplicated, but only one. And of course, my grant, I was, by the way, working on a grant from the Western Interstate Commission on Higher Education, and it did not include funds to go back to the Library of Congress and plow through 1,100 boxes to locate correspondence. So all I could do was rely on the survey, the Alaska Sea Project, of the Labrashevs. Now, I think briefly, I should indicate to you, and you may have some questions that I'll be happy to answer any that I can. What we should think about really is, what is the importance of this material for us in Alaska? Right away, I can tell you that two people are going to jump out of their skin. James Van Stone and Wendell Oswald are going to be beside themselves when they discover this material. They are two ethnographers who have been working in contiguous areas. Van Stone has been working down in the Michigan River area and has written a couple of very good books. One of his books, Eskimos of the Michigan River, is one of the best treatments, the best integrative efforts to weave the Orthodox experience into the life and the history of the people that I have read. And I've read practically everything. Wendell Oswald is doing archaeological and ethnographic work in the Kuskokwim River region, which is right in this area. Now, this material that comes through this archive is in a region that has been ignored both by ignored is a bad word. I mean, it has been neglected because the materials have not been available. And now that they are available, they're going to be very excited, and I'm sure we'll make great use of them. I should also emphasize that I did mention in passing, and I want to make it very clear, this material will not go back to the Library of Congress to be locked up in a vault where no one can use it. It will be kept in Kodiak at St. Herman's Pastoral School in an archive which is being developed there by the Orthodox Church in Alaska. In addition, the Orthodox Church is going to microfilm all of these documents and make them available to the entire scholarly world. This is a cooperative venture. The Alaska Historical Library and the Greater Anchorage Area Consortium Library are paying for the microfilming. So it's a marvelously cooperative venture, which is very exciting to see this stimulation of interest in both communities. Now, the ethnographers are interested in trying to find out how cultures change. In Alaska, an anthropologist has a difficult time finding out what the aboriginal, as they call it, or the base culture was. So they try to use techniques by studying the processes of cultural change to abstract back to what is called the aboriginal baseline culture. This is a laborious process that takes a long time, and they tend to work in very narrow areas, working in the Michigan River region, or studying a specific village and trying to learn everything they can find about that village, both in a historical perspective and in terms of its sociological composition of the moment. Now, these church documents for the ethnographers, as you can imagine, are invaluable tools. They have vital statistics, they tell about village settlement patterns, they have tribal compositions. The priest journals are in many cases the first reports by individuals in contact with these native cultures. Jacob Nitzvetov, for example, is the second Westerner, although he wasn't a Westerner because he was a Creole. He was a native of Atka. His father was the director of the Russian American Company. But he was the one who introduced this Western, if one terms Russian Orthodoxy Western, then that's another aspect of life to the natives of the Yukon River region. Lieutenant Zagoskin was probably the last Russian that these people had seen. Jacob Nitzvetov was the second. And that's, very important anthropological, ethnographic, historical, whatever term you want to use, important primary source material. And it's in this archive and nowhere else. That's very exciting. There are, in addition to the comments on native culture in general, some very interesting observations that students of native cultures can make from these documents about the intermingling. Now, this is is an interesting area because in this area encompassed by the Klipak Mission. Eskimos and Indians live in close proximity and in great intermingling. And the relationships between these two peoples is very interesting and can be studied, undoubtedly studied, from these documents. I should emphasize, my task did not involve translating these materials. That is another phase of this project, and has, hopefully, as a result of my report, based on these documents, there will be some funds generated to finance such excellent translators as Mrs. Shalcock to get into the materials themselves. Now, the anthropologists or ethnographers or ethnohistorians obviously have an interest in this material. What is the historian's interest? Well, obviously, I mean, it hardly seems to be necessary to ask, but historians have not been quick to turn their attention to cultural history in Alaska. There has been an overwhelming interest in political history and economic history, but not much in cultural history. They pretty much left it to the anthropologists to do this. It seems to me that for the historian, one can do a great deal with enhancing our understanding of the Russian period by studying the character of the Russian movement into the interior. Russian activity all along the coast has been studied and restudied and rehashed and retold many, many times. But most American historians have been really interested, I think, in why Russia sold Alaska to the United States. So there's been a great deal of interest in the beginnings, how Russia got onto the North American continent, and its endings. But not much about the middle period. And the exciting and really terribly dangerous and innovative work of the explorers. And I include these missionaries amongst the explorers because they were beating totally untried ground in their efforts. This story has not been adequately told at all. If you take a look at any of the secondary accounts or the histories, the surveys of Russian America, maybe only a sentence or two or a paragraph at most is devoted, well, for example, to Zagoskin's trip, and that's it. It's as if it stopped at that point. Nothing was done after Zagoskin went off the Yukon River. Another thing that the historian should keep in mind is to try to interweave cultural and political events to provide a more balanced view of the full range of Russian involvement in Alaska. There are actually, if one looks at it from the Orthodox point of view, in this one region, three distinct periods. The period beginning with priest Gregory Golovan's visit to Mikhailovsky Redoubt in 1843, until the sale of Alaska in 1867. That is a very clearly identifiable and extremely well-documented period now, thanks to this archive. Another period that's of great interest is the period from 1867 to approximately, 1895 or 1900, depending on a couple of variables. Then from 1900, when Father and later Bishop Amfiloke came to the Klipak area, to 1934 when he died, is another distinct period that can be well documented. And I'm told by Bishop Gregory today that all of Amfiloke's diaries came in the mail today. And this is fantastic material. Another thing to remember is that when Russia sold Alaska to the United States, almost all, in effect, all of the Russian American Company officials left. But the Russian Orthodox readers and a few priests, a great many priests did leave, but four were left. And all of the readers who were natives, Creoles, remained. church developed and built up steam again. And so this is a continuum. Russian Orthodoxy spans the Russian and the American period, unlike any other officials or individuals, except the natives themselves, who unfortunately were largely illiterate or inarticulate or certainly did not leave records, except in their dealings with this institution, the church. Another thing that I think historians can do with this kind of material is to correct the bias that I mentioned earlier, that the Russian Orthodox Church was, by and large, a failure in Alaska. I think that any reading of these documents will reveal the extraordinarily tolerant and humane attitude of the Orthodox toward their missionary field. And I think this is something that has had great appeal in Alaska. Today, the Orthodox Church is, no one wants to commit themselves to this, and the Orthodox themselves are rather, don't want to stick themselves out on them, but my guess is that they are the single most representative church for Alaska's natives. They conservatively estimate their active communicants as somewhere around 10,000. The higher figure would be 30,000, but even using the lowest figure, that means that almost all of the Orthodox in Alaska are natives. That then encompasses approximately one-fifth of the native population of Alaska. Now, given that fact, we certainly can't believe that Orthodoxy was a failure in Alaska. It is for Americans, a rather seemingly exotic religion. Strange in many of its practices, although it's not really, but it seems that way. And yet, it is strong and growing and popular amongst a very large group of Native Americans, which is of significance in itself. The Orthodox, obviously, played an extremely important role in Alaskan history. They were the dominant religion from approximately 1741 until well after the sale of Alaska, until the first Protestant missionaries appeared in the 1880s. They played an extremely important role in education in Alaska. For many years after Russia sold Alaska, Russia sold Alaska to the United States, Russia spent much more on education in Alaska than the United States did. The first appropriation for education in Alaska was not made until 1884. And the Russian government had been financing parish schools throughout Alaska all during those 20 years, and well after that as well. The Orthodox Church was also an important institution in defense of purely native interests. Now, it's not in the character of the Orthodox Church to involve itself in politics very much. And whenever it did involve itself in the defense of native interests, it was because they felt that the secular power, which in the first case was the Russian American Company, and later on the American government, American officials, were preventing the natives from exercising their religious freedom. And there, as you undoubtedly know as historians, there were many instances of Protestant missionaries coming into Orthodox communities and trying to win the people away from their established faith, feeling that they weren't really Christians. And a great deal of conflict arose as a result of that. And that story is one that is well documented in the document, in the file that has come to us, particularly because amongst all the documents, and I think I've neglected to mention this, there are a large number of issues of the Russian Orthodox American Messenger. And these contain extremely interesting articles about the conflicts between the Orthodox and the the Protestant sects with which they were competing. There are a number of petitions to the United States government, one open letter by Bishop Nicholas to the President of the United States, President McKinley, protesting the situation of the Orthodox in Alaska. And this kind of thing can be followed very nicely through the files of the Russian Orthodox American Messenger. Another thing that I particularly hope will occur to historians as a result of this is to bring to light important individuals who have been ignored unjustifiably. Jacob Nitsvetov's name is probably unknown to all but a handful of you. And yet he was a very great missionary, a great linguist. He probably, according to those who have read his diaries, ranks right behind Veniaminov. By the way, Veniaminov's works have not been translated into English. This is another thing that desperately needs to be done.
I was greatly impressed by the infirmity of the Protestant group, they're primarily Reagan's, to making headway and converting those Orthodox native villagers, even though they had no resident priest, just the natives that would read the material. Apparently, they had certain things to read for every Sunday in the year and all of the holidays, and they did that very carefully. And apparently, the Moravians were never able to make any headway in converting those villages.
That really is an interesting point, and something that I think is, again, an aspect of this that should be more, well, it should have stimulated historical curiosity a long time ago, because in my estimation, the Orthodox have really not been, emotional proselytizers. They're very patient. They have not really attempted to move out of the of their historic areas. This is interesting. They haven't gone up into northern Alaska. Most of their area is still the historic area that it was in 1867. It doesn't extend beyond Morton Sound. And they have just concentrated on the areas where they began, and they are identified with native interests by and large, and I think that's been their strength. And they've relied on that, and they've built on it, and they've grown. And it's true that I was talking with a girl who lives in the Lake Iliamna area, and she said that there was a resident Baptist church there, but whenever the Orthodox priest made his circuit, which is what they do, they have a large circuit they have to cover in order to provide communion at least once a year to everybody, which is, by the way, the primary function of a priest in a liturgical faith. Whenever the Orthodox priest would come into town, the Baptist church was empty. And that was their home church. That was where they went. And she'd never really thought about this before, and I said I thought that was very interesting. But there are many stories of that sort. And the Moravian experience has been written about by Wendell Oswald in a book called Mission of Change, Eskimos along the Kuskokwim River, and he discusses the Moravian mission to that region, to the Bethel area.
Did he do a book on Papiaka?
Napaskiak.
Yeah,
that's
on the opposite side from Napaskiak. That's right.
Yeah.
And Napaskiak, the Russian, those people don't allow their children, if they can prevent it, they don't allow their children to intermarry with the ones half mile across the river at Napaskiak. I thought that was getting pretty careful.
Yeah. Can't be too careful.
That's the attitude.
Not intermarriage.
How has the, say like taking Russian mission, for example, how has the dogma of the church in 1845 been adapted to village life by the people?
In what respect?
Well, the philosophy, how has it been incorporated into village life so that perhaps the traditional and superstitious or religious heritage of the people in the village was incorporated into your sort of daily existence with...
Well, I should first say I am not an expert on Russian Orthodoxy or on how it has actually worked in fact, because I'm not Orthodox, and all I can say is what I have studied from the reading of these documents and talking with the officials today. There was, Bishop Innocent, in his instructions, I brought these because they say it so much better than I, and I hope maybe an occasion might arise to say something about it. He has, in these instructions written in 1841, injunctions against being overly critical of things such as polygamy. And he said, for example, do not fail to baptize someone who has a marriage that might be too close within the limits required by the law, Leviticus, because they were ignorant of the laws. And The Orthodox learned from experience. They learned that Juvenali was killed in Lake Iliamna because he was trying to break up polygamous marriages of the chief. And he also, according to legend at least, was trying to take villagers away from their homes to educate them, to educate the children. This raises another interesting little aspect of Orthodox history and Alaskan history that is very pertinent today. On the basis of this experience, the Orthodox became defenders of the village school. In contrast to the Protestant missionaries who wanted to set up Protestant homes and take, or missionary homes, and take the kids away from their families, put them into boarding schools. And in the pages of the Russian Orthodox American Messenger, you read exactly the same arguments that one hears from native leaders today against the state-operated boarding home system. And it was the native priests, or rather the Orthodox priests, who were speaking the words then in exactly the same terms as they are said today. The Orthodox were believed that they would eventually succeed by example. I think many of you notice that Orthodox graveyards in villages, and if, as a matter of fact, I've read many complaints about this, that the graves are pagan symbols. Obviously, the Orthodox must have failed. Well, in effect, what happened was they were willing to say, well, this kind of thing isn't that important. Give them time. Time we have all eternity. This is really their feeling. They have a much, much more patient attitude toward their religious mission than any other missionary activity that I have ever had any familiarity with. So I know that isn't really a direct answer to your question, because I don't honestly know, except that they are seem to me to be a more tolerant, relatively tolerant religious group in terms of local customs, and are willing to. They don't necessarily, they don't condone these things, and they desire to change pagan ways, but not by condemnation outright, but by education and exposure to a different way over time.
Do you know whether that church is still standing at Russian Mission? We understood when we were there that they didn't use it except on very rare occasion because it was considered unsafe. That was in 27, so it's undoubtedly deteriorated a lot, but still standing.
No, it's been rebuilt. And as a matter of fact, there was a picture in the paper a few days ago of some teachers who, in fact, there was a full-page spread on Ecognew. I was really excited to see that. Some teachers were up there for the summer, and there was a picture of the church, and it's quite a large church. It has a brightly painted dome. So it's obviously in use, and it has been reconstructed. One thing that's that I'd like to mention too, there's one mistake that has, you know, this is the way things get started and never stop. Apparently, because the Russian originals have never been put on microfilm of the Library of Congress holdings, we're extremely dependent on Tikhon Lavrishev's translations. And I've discovered that Wendell Oswalt and even the Orthodox people at St. Herman's have perpetuated a mistake, which I can't trace because we don't have the microfilm. But Father Ilarion succeeded, who was a monk, succeeded Ms. Fyatov as priest at Russian Mission. And his journals were translated by Lavrishev. And at one point, he indicates that Ilarion was going down to Nushigak to meet with Ms. Fyatov. This was before Ms. Fyatov retired. And there's a little footnote that Nushigak was the headquarters of the Yukon River Mission. And that footnote has been retained in all kinds of scholarly things, and it's absolutely incorrect. Nushigak was never the headquarters of the Yukon River Mission, as nearly as I can tell. It was thought it might be. There was some thought that they would That was one place they were considering. But then they decided it would be just too hard for him to get from Inishagak up to all the way up the Yukon. And somehow this, you know, again, if we could get this material on microfilm, get the Russian originals, we could clear up this kind of thing that has perpetuated an error that many people, you know, quite legitimately have just carried on and on and on. Well, I thank you for your attention, and I hope that you'll be reading a lot more about the Orthodox Church in Alaska in future years. Attention. This is Orthodox Alaska, which is published by the Orthodox Church in Alaska. It is the one place where you can